and welcome to Parenting Help with Vigeo Behavior Consulting. Join us for conversations with experts in the fields of cognitive behavior, mental health, behavior analysis, education, and child psychology. On this podcast, we examine the challenges that parents are facing and share insights and strategies that have helped other parents with similar issues. I'm your host, Katie Palmer. I'm a parenting coach and board-certified behavior analyst. I'm also the owner of Vigeo Behavior Consulting. I am fortunate to be able to engage in conversations with some incredible professionals whose depth and breadth of experience can offer guidance for parents who are looking for new ideas. I hope you find this podcast useful, engaging, and insightful. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us. We're going to mix it up a little bit today. And I am going to be joined by a wonderful guest who will be introduced in a moment. And I am also going to play the role of a guest on our podcast today. And our host will be the brilliant and thoughtful Julia Van Trompont. And Julia, I will turn it over to you right now.
Thank you, Katie. Yes, I have the honor of introducing our guest, Jill. Jill Saxon, PhD, BCBAD, is a board-certified behavior analyst in a private practice and the founder of Functional Behavior Solutions. Jill earned her doctoral degree in developmental psychology from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and trained for her BCBA at Douglas Developmental Disabilities Center at Rutgers University. Her practice focuses on children with autism spectrum disorder, anxiety and OCD symptoms, feeding challenges, behavioral challenges, sleep and toileting difficulties, and ADHD in their families. Jill has particular interest in family-based approaches to build adaptive coping skills, emotional regulation, and behavioral flexibility through acceptance and commitment therapy. Jill is also trained in SPACE, supportive parenting for anxious childhood emotions, and a caregiver-based approach to reducing children's anxiety and OCD symptoms, as well as to address ARFID and other pediatric feeding concerns. Wow, Jill, impressive bio. I'm so excited to talk to you today. How are you doing?
Thank you so much. Sorry I sent you such a long bio, Julia.
No, it's great.
Well, thank you and Katie very much for the invitation. Thank you.
Yeah, this is really a topic that is so present in much of my work with parents. And a lot of the work that I do is with parents and with schools and teachers. And I'm really excited to have your expertise with this on our show.
Well, thank you very much. I'm passionate about this topic and feel so fortunate to be able to share it.
I would love it if we could start today by talking about accommodating, parental accommodations. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about the background on that and what is normal? What's normal accommodating? What does that look like?
Well, I think when we think from a parent-child perspective about the kinds of things that parents do to respond to kids, parents respond to kids in all sorts of ways. And thank goodness they do, right? Child is hungry from the moment they are born and they are crying and they're seeking some response to that need that they have. Kids then go on to ask for all sorts of things, both verbally, vocally, and otherwise by demonstrating that they need help with things. And parents are really coaches and teachers and educational consultants to their kids in a lot of ways and have play a lot of roles. And so parents are doing a lot of responding and reacting to their kids. And when we start thinking about what is an accommodation, when we think about it from this perspective of accommodations for anxiety or OCD or other kinds of behaviors that can be challenging to kids and families, I think what we're thinking about is things that parents are doing in response to their child's fear or anxious emotion that they wouldn't be doing otherwise, right? So if we think about If a parent has multiple children and one child is exhibiting fear, anxiety, or concern about novelty in relation to their food, for instance, what is the parent doing with that child to respond or avoid some of those anxious feelings or uncomfortable feelings that they wouldn't be doing if the child wasn't exhibiting those anxious or uncomfortable feelings? And I think that's where we're using the word accommodation as opposed to parenting, right? And accommodating is part of all normal parenting. But I think that's the piece that I think Katie and I, you know, kind of were picking up on that we wanted to talk about today. Yeah, Katie?
Yeah, definitely. And I do think that idea of what's normal, because there's so much that we do as parents where we accommodate or address the needs of our child. And then there's a tipping point where we are engaging in accommodating behaviors that turn out not to be helpful for our child's development. And hopefully what we can do a little bit today is draw that distinction for parents and help them understand that when I behave in a way to prevent something that I think is going to happen in the future, if I create accommodations around my child, even if the anxious symptoms are not even present, but I imagine, oh, this is coming up, and therefore my child is likely to exhibit certain behaviors, I'm going to do some accommodating so that that doesn't happen. Some of those components can lead to a slippery slope where families are not engaging in sort of values-directed behaviors for their family as a whole in order to avoid what they believe might happen.
I was going to give an example. Can I give an example?
Please, please.
So let's think about a child who has a lot of anxiety and anxious emotions and related behaviors in the lead up to birthday parties, mm-hmm. right? So this child has a lot of fear about who might be there, who might talk to them, whether their mom is going to stay with them or not going to stay with them, whether there's going to be the right kind of food for the child to eat. So the child has a lot of anxious thoughts and anxious feelings in the lead up to a birthday party. A parent has a lot of choices in that moment about what to do, how to handle it. Do I kind of push her and tell her go, it's going to be fine, you can do it? Do I let her not go? Do I say, you know what, it's just a birthday party. Birthday parties are really not that important, right? And just let her skip it. Or do I go with her and kind of hold her hand until she feels comfortable, or let her sit with me till she feels comfortable? Do I bring food for her that I know she's going to be comfortable to eat? Do I talk to the parents of the birthday child ahead of time and tell them where my child might feel comfortable sitting, or what kind of group, if there's going to be, you know, some sort of like, you know, groups that the kids are going to be put in at the birthday party? Or do I warn the parents of the birthday child that my child might not want to participate, or we might have to leave early? So what are the things that I do as a parent in thinking about my child being anxious? What do I do to possibly avoid that situation? Maybe even having her not go, or ensuring that she doesn't feel anxious by going with her or bringing her food that she likes. How do I avoid those feelings, and what do I do? How do I, you know, kind of respond to her in the moment once, if we decide to go to the birthday party, how do I respond to her in the moment when she's feeling anxious? And so I think that what Katie said was something really important, because these are decisions that parents often make kind of impulsively, right? Like, I don't kind of know what to do, so I'm just going to pick a thing to do, or I'm just going to be kind of reactive, because parents get really caught up and push or pull. And I think the piece that we want to think about is, well, what is it that's important in the situation to the parent? There's the values piece that we have from acceptance commitment therapy, right? So what kind of values are important in this? Well, is socializing important? Is having good friends important to our family? Is teaching my child to be independent something that's important to my family, is having my child understand that even if they're not that excited about the birthday party, the whole point of the birthday party is to support the child whose birthday it is. So some sort of kind of, you know, value oriented around caring for others. So all of these come into play when the parent is faced with this situation of, my child is anxious about this upcoming event. Do I push? Do I not push? Do I avoid? Do I go with? What do I do? And all of those pieces are decision points that parents have to make and that are in relation to the possibility of accommodating.
And how do we, as parents, right, how do we slow ourselves down to make that choice intentionally, if you will? I really appreciated how you said all these choices show up for us. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes we will just grab at one to make the choice and to do something. What have you learned in your practice and in your training that would help you guide a parent to how to make that choice? And I love to focus on, what are we avoiding? Is that worth the result of continuing to avoid something? And what are we pushing towards or guiding our child towards?
As an outcome.
Yeah. How do we make that choice?
So your question, I think that what you're picking up on in that moment is the parent's choice.
Yeah.
And what I love that you're, what I love about this is that the focus of paying attention to accommodations and deciding what to do about accommodations is all about the parent.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So that's what's really, really a wonderful approach when we start thinking about it from that perspective. When we start thinking about children's anxious emotions and fears and discomfort from the parent's perspective, and how parents have this amazing opportunity to pay attention to their own behaviors and their own responses and reactions in order to make change, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, coming up. So parents have this opportunity unilaterally to pay attention to their own responding and make decisions about that. I think there's a lot of regulation skills that parents can work on and be taught and can learn on their own. And I think that the education about what is an accommodation and how do accommodations function for children and for parents. And I think that education piece can often be a wonderful kind of like building block and foundation for helping parents make those choices, either ahead of time or in the moment. I don't know, Katie, do you have other thoughts about what parents might be able to do to help themselves, to support themselves in the moment as they have those decisions to make?
What showed up for me when you started talking about this choice is, there are one of the reasons that I work with parents more often than I work with children is because the impact of those choices that they can make is larger than they know. And that has been consistently my experience with parents who come to me feeling pretty helpless. They have really, and maybe even hopeless. They have tried so many things and they are starting to doubt, you know, how good they are as a parent. And can we empower them to feel that some of their own behavior within their own control can improve their child's interaction with their environment and improve their child's behaviors, or some of the ones that they're looking to change? Yes, Julie.
I have to jump in, and I this might be a hot take, but the point that you said about they've tried so many things, I often wonder if they perceive themselves as trying so many things because they've called the experts, they've talked to the teachers, they've made the appointments for therapy, they've put support folks in contact with their kids, but it's their children who are being asked to function with those modalities, and they're being asked to participate, and they're the ones who are doing the change and doing the work. And parents are critical in that bridging and connecting. However, it is so frequent in my experience that the parents are like, I've done so much. And it's like, have we looked at ourselves? Have we stopped to answer the question of what you are doing? And that's that I feel like we're circling around this point of what can a person control? They can control themselves. And that's it.
It's not always, so behavior occurs in a context. Behavior, yes. Our child's behavior occurs in the environment in which they exist. And one of the ways that I love to introduce parents to this idea that they have the ability to change some of what they're doing or even just reframing how they're looking at a problem. And when they do that, they shift the environment just enough or just a little. And the child has different opportunities to respond. The child's environment begins to provide them different ways to get their needs met. And that's a bit of I feel like that's a little bit of a 10, 25,000 foot level thing. And I spend a lot of time praising and hopefully supporting parents and all of the work they've done to get their child access to, you know, whether it's behavioral help or therapeutic help or occupational therapy or speech and language pathologists, because all of those things are going to help. And if they arrive on my doorstep, usually it's because those things have not yet been enough, or it hasn't moved the needle enough for where they want to be. And so adding this parent behavior component, let's start to talk about what you're doing that impacts your child's environment in a way that is, as Jill was mentioning earlier, it's how we parent. We take care of our child's needs. We fix what's wrong. Mm-hmm. But when we are talking about anxiety, when we're talking about OCD, the things that our child is perceiving as wrong are not always true. They feel it. The emotions are true. But their mind is giving them a story that is not based in real experience. It's based in worry and fear. I don't know if that's a really great way to sort of summarize anxiety, but jump in here. And
well, I think that you did a really nice job of talking about a few different things. So anxiety is our brain and body's response to something that's not actually present, right? Mm-hmm. So fear, the way a lot of people, you know, like to talk about it, fear is the thing that's happening right now. Right? There's a bear in front of me right now. I'm going to respond with that kind of fight or flight that we all know about. Mm-hmm. Anxiety is something that humans do, which is that we have fear-based responding to something that isn't actually present, really fear-based responding to our own talking to ourselves, right? Our own thoughts about the bear or about the birthday party. I want to pick up on a couple things that you said, Katie, if that's okay. So one thing is that all parents accommodate. And I said that earlier, but I really want to say that again, right? This is not a problem behavior that parents have. All parents accommodate. Good parents accommodate. And this language is from Eli Lebowitz and his SPACE program, which Katie and I are going to talk about in a few minutes. So these are not, this isn't, you know, my language. This is his language. Parents who care accommodate. Right? Parents who want the best for their child, accommodate. And the other piece is that parents try really hard to make their anxious kids do things differently, right? And I say make in quotes, right? Because they try really hard to get their kid to do the thing, right? Like they don't, it's not like the first time the kid says, I don't want to go to a birthday party, they say, you don't have to go. I know it's too hard for you. Probably those parents have had a lot of times where they really did try to get their kid to go to the birthday party or to the soccer game or to the hockey game or whatever that is. And the context that the child's anxiety is a part of gives us an opportunity to make an impact, right? So it's really hard to cause a person to do a different thing. especially when the thing is their thoughts or their feelings. It's really hard to say, don't think about that. Don't think that. Don't think that. Don't think that birthday party's scary. It's not scary. That's a really hard thing to convince a child of, at least permanently. Maybe
it doesn't usually work, does it?
I mean, if it works, it's going to be quick, right? But it's not going to last. And so I think that's what gives us this beautiful opportunity, right? If we recognize that all parents accommodate, it's a natural way that parents take care of their children, and children seeking of accommodation is also a natural thing, because their whole way of infants connecting with parents and getting what they need, right, is through communicating that they're in distress. That's how it starts, right? That's why babies get fed and held and kept warm. So this all makes sense. And so it also gives us an opportunity for intervention, right? If we can't make the kid do the thing, we know we can't make them think differently about it, what else can we do? And that's where this work steps in.
Yeah, I have an article pulled up here that talks about the space program that we're going to start chatting about. And something that's in this that I loved is a therapist requesting the parent to log their accommodations and bringing awareness to what they are doing and when they're doing it. And you use the word make, which I love, because it is this kind of, it turns into that. I think it starts as an accommodation of, you know, oh, let me help you. And then it turns into, let me make it so that it's easy for you to do this. And then I'm going to make you try to do this sort of thing. And you can see also how the anxiety goes from just being the child's anxiety to also the parent's anxiety, and depleting their energy and their resources and their time to be a whole person who can show up and actually provide those accommodations with meaningful, effective, compassionate responding. And it's such a vicious cycle. You can really see that it just gets compounded. And so I loved that, logging the accommodations, logging the behavior so that there could be perspective, and seeing how things shift and how things have changed over time. But I feel like I might have jumped ahead there with I'd love to go further into space.
It's a great segue. Yeah. And I want to acknowledge also, I borrowed that technique recently for one of my one-on-one staff who's working in a school, and in a school setting, you know, trying to ensure the child is successful has involved a great deal of accommodating. And this particular staff member is so tuned in to this child's behavior that she is anticipating problems and removing the obstacles. And she's doing that or as a result of her doing that, the child's challenging behaviors have dropped to zero in the school setting, which means he's experiencing a great deal of success. And so what we're doing now is we're tracking accommodations that she is doing as her behavior, as the adult behavior, in order to demonstrate to his teams, like, look, he is doing wonderfully. If you consider pulling the one-on-one support, we want you to recognize the amount of accommodating that's happening for him so he can be successful in this particular context. We don't know if you remove that, if things will change for him. But yeah, I do also really want, because this article did speak about the space program, I really do want to spend a little bit of time asking for your thoughts, Jill, and your experience with that program. And we're going to put links and shout outs in the show notes for Dr. Lebowitz and his program, certainly. And we'll put links to these articles as well.
Before we kind of go on, I want to follow up on something you both said, which Katie, you just said that this child's observable behavior
perfect
has improved as a result of the accommodations. And I think that it's a good opportunity to point out, you know, we've been talking about accommodations, but we didn't say why they matter. Right. And I think that we could talk a minute about why they matter. And I think that everyone who's familiar with like negative reinforcement, this will sound really familiar. And I think it goes even beyond that. So again, this is from Eli Leibowitz and his space program. He talks about the accommodation cycle. So he talks about it starts with the child is exhibiting some sort of distress or some sort of anxiety symptoms or some sort of fear. And then for whatever reason, the family accommodates in some way. They avoid the situation. They reassure the child that he'll be okay. They modify their behavior in some sort of way to make sure that the child doesn't feel anxious. And what happens? Well, the child reduces their level of distress. That makes sense. And so then what happens? The parents see that when they stepped in, their child felt better. And this child sees that when their parents stepped in, they felt better. And so now both parties in this both come to believe that they need the parent to step in order for the child to feel better. And what happens over time? Oh, the child continues to experience those symptoms, or they don't because the parent has avoided it before it's even happened. And in that whole cycle of accommodation, we've never had an opportunity for the child to learn to cope or to practice coping. And that's the piece that is the kind of the key to understanding why this matters. In that cycle of accommodation, what's missing is an opportunity for the child to try it and the child to learn. And so that's what you're speaking to, Katie, is how do we pay attention to what accommodations a school or a teacher or a staff member or a parent is providing? And then what do you think? Could we start to remove them a little at a time to see if we can give the child the opportunity to practice coping?
I so appreciate that summary. Yes, such a beautiful encapsulation of not just the pattern, but the potential problems and also the opportunity for skill building in a supportive, gradual way.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And that is very consistent with behavioral science, right? Is let's figure out what the kid needs to do, give them opportunities to do it a little bit at a time so they can keep getting stronger and stronger at it.
Yeah, I feel like this is a great time to start talking about maybe some of the frameworks that that SPACE, which I just want to say the acronym for our parents who might be listening and wondering, what is SPACE, 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 SPACE? Supportive Parenting for Anxious Childhood Emotions. So this is a program that looks at what parents are doing, what their behavior is. So I mentioned earlier logging the accommodating behaviors and starting to change that. I would love to talk a little bit more about the supporting components of other members in this framework, because in this article by Eli Leibowitz, there's mentions of, you know, communicating with teachers, with family members, with neighbors, people who are a part of that network that the family is built of. You know, it's not just our nuclear family or family of origin. It's also the environments that child is existing in different spaces. And so, yeah, because, you know, sometimes at school, it is the teacher who's being asked to, or is instinctively jumping in and doing accommodations, or it is maybe an ABA provider or a different therapy provider, OT, we talked about speech pathology. What does, how do we bring those all in together? How do we look at what a parent's behavior is, but also how a parent can work with these other support systems to address some of those behaviors?
So I'm going to answer this question in two different ways. So one of the pieces that's really important in terms of working with outside people and getting support, a big piece of that is actually supporting the parents when they decide what accommodation to remove. So in the SPACE program, the first piece of the accommodation attending is what you mentioned, Julia, which is mapping it all out. So actually watching their own behavior after they've learned all the different ways that parents might be responding in this accommodating way, they map out over the course of some number of days or weeks, how they are accommodating. What do they do when the child wakes up in the morning that might be different than they would do for another child who wasn't feeling anxious? What do they do at dinner time? What do they do at bedtime, et cetera? What do they do at school? What do they do what happens at school? What happens at their aftercare program? So one of the pieces is mapping it out, and that might involve getting the involvement of other people who spend time with the child to understand what else is happening during the day. And then the parent is going to choose one accommodation to change or reduce or remove. And at that time, the parent might need support from other people. So for instance, an example of a child who is always picked up from school because they are anxious about getting on the bus. Well, in that situation, if the parent says, I'm not going to be picking up the child anymore as part of this plan to reduce accommodations, then we're going to need some backup, because how do we get the kid on the bus, right? And so there's going to need to be some collaboration with the people at the school, the professionals at the school, about what do we do if the child is having a hard time getting on the bus? What do we do if the child refuses to get on the bus? What do we do if the bus leaves and the child did not get on the bus? What do we do? Is the parent going to go pick the child up if they said they weren't? Well, probably not. We probably don't want to have that as part of the plan. What we might do is have a neighbor here's another supportive person, right? Here's another person that we're going to be seeking support from in this plan, because maybe that neighbor is going to go pick up the child because the child does need to get home, but we don't want to give in to that accommodation. I want to say one other thing, Katie, if that's okay, because I think we just missed one piece that I don't want us to miss. Because what we're talking about is removing accommodations, which is really hard and really stressful to even think about. I want to say two things, actually. One is it does not happen all at once. There is no pulling off a Band-Aid. Okay, so we are always just thinking about the next tiny little thing that the child is going to be able to handle.
This is not like tough love, do it all situation.
No,
that you're talking about this. Yeah.
100%, right? 100%. So initially, maybe it's the child just has to look at the bus, you know, walk out to the bus line, and then mom gets in. Who knows, right? Depending on what's appropriate for that individual child. But that handling it is really important, and it's a piece we haven't talked about yet. So the plan for removing or reducing accommodation comes with something else, which is the plan for improving and increasing support. And it's support in the way that you were just talking about, right? And that we need the community to support. But it also is support for the child's feelings and stress and anxiety. And in the SPACE program, the word support means acceptance and validation of the feelings, but also confidence that the child can handle those feelings. So I know how hard it is for you to get on that bus, and I know how scary it is, and I have 100% confidence that you can handle those scary feelings. So that confidence and support for the child's ability to handle is really important, and it's an important part of this program. So I just didn't want to keep going without saying that. I'm not sure I fully answered your question about school, and I'm wondering if I could hand it off to Katie for that piece to answer the rest of that question.
Yeah, I think casting my mind back. I asked like six questions in that one, I think. What it looks like to begin to pull in those support systems. And honestly, Jill, I think you did a great job bringing into consideration that point about that it's not just about supporting the individual with with the skills component and shaping those skills. It's not just, like you said, ripping the bandage off. It's definitely kind of wrap around with, it's almost a different accommodation, but the idea is that we're teaching or shaping a skill for coping mechanisms, and that the person will then internalize and have the ability to self-accommodate. But yeah, of how we can support the parents. So at that point about, okay, when the fail-safe needs to be called in, it's the neighbor, it's someone else who's going to, you know, come in and provide that, I don't want to call it an accommodation anymore, but provide that point of bridging the gap, basically. And, you know, that will support the individual, that will support the family, that will support the parent in moving forward with changing their behavior. But also, in a classroom setting, it can be challenging for a teacher. Maybe if it's a classroom where there's only one teacher, sometimes I'm in spaces where there are two teachers in the classroom. And that's really awesome because they can kind of tag team and provide support where needed. But when it is just one person in the room and, you know, the individuals at school or with peers, and how to navigate that, what does that support look like? What are those follow throughs on the directive looking like, I suppose? So Katie,
yeah, the school situation that I was describing is a really excellent example of this. That child does have a one-on-one support, but I want to acknowledge that when we are making changes to accommodating behaviors and we are wrapping around, you know, the community and our other support team around this process, we do have to remember that sometimes the system or the setting that we're in is not a safe place to do this. And in that particular school setting, I, with 100% confidence, know that all of these adults love and care for this child and would approach a process like this with open arms if the setting allowed for it. And so what we sometimes have to do is slow our process down and say, here's an intervention that we can begin. Can we look at what it would take to put this intervention in place? And is the environment ready for that? Is a classroom setting and all the other children's needs still going to be met? And can we ensure that all of the other children are still going to thrive? If we see, you know, a slight increase in those symptoms of distress as we support this child through coping. And sometimes the answer is not yet. Sometimes the answer is we might need two more resources in, whether it's time or a space to be in, or another adult. There might be other things we need to put in place before we can begin the process. And that really is just thinking through the impact of an intervention on the entire context. And as I've been coaching this one-on-one staff about this topic of accommodations, I've hopefully really communicated that her behavior of accommodating is not a bad thing. It actually has created an opportunity and an environment around the child where he can experience educational success and where the other adults in the building are starting to view him in a more positive light. So we do have to remember that when a child is exhibiting large behaviors, tantruming or aggression or dangerous behaviors to others in response to their own distress, that others in a school setting will perceive that child in a particular way. And yeah. So some of what we are accommodating is shaping so slowly that the child is experiencing success. Others are perceiving the child as successful and a positive part of their world. And so when we consider shaking things up a bit so that this child can engage in some learning around coping skills, we have to think about all those components. I don't think I've given really a clear answer there, but more as we approach a situation like that, there's a lot to think about.
Yeah, you have answered it for me, but I also feel like, oh man, that's a lot of other questions. And you hit the nail on the head about how a child is perceived by their peers, by their educators, by their community when they're having those bigger expressions and responses to their anxiety. And, you know, the phrase that I really clung to there, and I'm curious for Jill and Katie about this, of sometimes these changes are, the environment is not a safe place to do this. And obviously the school itself is safe. You know, there, and there is care, there is support. There's also the oversight of the educators who are obligated to keep these children safe as well. But safe in the term of like, this isn't the best place to do an experimental change here, because there's so many variables that can't be controlled. And when you're trying to make changes, you change one thing at a time. And what does that look like when that is at home, where maybe it's not a safe environment for those changes because there are siblings, because there are variables like family that travels for work, or maybe they work from home. And so there's different constraints on the space of the home, where when proximity seeking behaviors are being displayed to regulate and to comfort the child, a parent isn't available because they're on a work call and they're home, but they're not home. You know, what does that look like when those variables are existing in the home? And I have another question, but I'll pause there and see what we have.
First thing that comes to mind is, are we talking about the same function? And we don't know in that context, especially, you know, a parent who is engaged in a higher priority moment. Is the function to, for the child to alleviate their distress, or is it something else? Or is it a combination, right? So that's the first thing that kind of shows up for me. I want to also acknowledge that this idea of when is it safe to try out some coping skills, I am borrowing that and adopting it from some of the work of Dr. Stapleton and Dr. Cassidy's MAGPIES program, and as well as the way that Dr. Stapleton on this podcast anyway, articulated how we understand masking and when to mask and when not to mask for neurodivergent populations. So I just wanna shout out to that. Jill, what shows up for you in that concept of safe with regard to if we shift our thinking to a home environment?
I don't know if I'm gonna address the word safe necessarily, but maybe ready would be okay to address. Just like we said, from the child's perspective, we are not ripping off a Band-Aid and just, or, you know, to use another metaphor, throwing them in the deep end without any life raft, right? We are doing the same thing for parents. So when we're asking for them to become aware of their accommodations and the ways that they respond to their child's anxiety or other kinds of distress symptoms, and then we ask them to work with us or on their own to identify where they might change that or reduce that, we are not throwing them into the deep end. They do not need to stop all of their accommodations at once. So we are not asking them to stop responding to their child in a way that is going to interfere with work or whatever that is, right? We are looking for something that's doable for the parent and doable for the child. So we want both parties to be able to have the opportunity to start at a place where they can be successful, right? And so I think that, I don't know if that quite answers your question, Julia, but I hope that that sets people up to understand that even just thinking about not responding to a child in a huge level of distress while you're also on a work call, like that's probably too tall an order for a lot of families who have been going through this. So we're going to pick something that makes sense. We're going to pick something that happens frequently enough that we're going to get practice, because we know how important that is, and happens at a time that availability and possibly external support and possibly the lack of interference from other children might be possibility. And I think that's, so I think that answers some of your question. I'm not sure if it answers your full question.
That does answer. And also I like the use of the word ready as opposed to safe, because safe sounds, unsafe is such a loaded term. And I don't mean to imply that like the home is not safe, but rather that, yeah, the environment isn't ready or not primed to be a successful change, essentially. And yeah, in a school setting, just to jump back and forth for a second, it can be next to impossible to have that environment completely primed for those changes. But sometimes I've seen where it is similarly challenging in the home to be able to target one thing at a time, because there are so many variables. I'm picturing the scene in Poltergeist when they open the door and something's spinning over here and something's zooming over there and it's just chaotic, and then they shut the door. And sometimes that is how it is when you've got multiple kids in the house and that everyone's on different schedules. You know, little Susie has soccer at 5 and little Jimmy has, you know, football over here, and someone has to go to this for pottery. And also we're going to have family over for dinner tonight because they're in town for the weekend. And it's like, wow. And we're going to try to ask parents and child to make changes and do all these things. It just can be such a to use your phrase, a tall order to make a first step, you know? So yeah, I was curious about what that would look like. And so that does help of what can we practice? What can we do regularly? What can we be successful at? Because I imagine also, not only is the child's perception of success important, but a parent's perception of success with themselves matters in this narrative.
In the preparation for changes like this that we're talking about, so what we're talking about overall is parents changing their own behavior, changing their accommodating behavior, which Jill, as you so beautifully pointed out, has in their eyes been working. It has alleviated the distress and maybe kept things running smoothly in the family. And some of the preparation is actually way before we commit to making a change in that parent behavior, even just helping the parents recognize what's going on and recognize that what the success that they've seen is a short-term success. It's a short-term relief of potential problems that in the long run is not as helpful for their child or their family or themselves as they perceive it to be. And that component there is sometimes a hard thing to address. And it's something that I tend to work with gently for parents, because as you mentioned earlier, Jill, good parents accommodate. Parents who care accommodate. This isn't about, hey, you've been doing this wrong. It's more about this thing that's been working for you may not be workable. Or if they've come to us, it's probably starting to become unworkable. And we're helping them to take a look at all the components with self-compassion and say, yeah, we think this has got to shift because it's become a bit, you know, the anxiety gets bigger when we engage in the accommodating behaviors. I believe a sort of a summary statement might be, the anxiety actually gets worse. Is that fair to say?
I mean, how cool is it that there's an evidence-based procedure, there's an evidence-based model that says that even though the anxiety isn't the parent's fault, that the parents can have an impact? Like, how cool is that, right? That even though they did not cause it, because they didn't, they can have an impact. Just like if there was, you know, just like if your child, you know, stubbed their toe, you didn't do that, but you might be able to help them feel better with Tylenol or ice, right? And how cool is that, that you have this this role to play? And then I think to answer the other piece and follow up on what Katie was saying is there is some work for parents to be able to pay attention to short-term relief versus long-term rewards, right? So accommodation is great in the short run. It helps the child feel better, and it also helps the parent feel better. If I just put my kids' shoes on, they will get outside and I will be able to get to school and work on time. That is going to be short-term relief for the child and short-term relief for myself. But over time, we see that that's not going to help us get the child out of the house and in some other longer, you know, kind of longer term way. And so sometimes that we have to learn to tolerate and cope and handle the short-term discomfort of our child and of ourselves in order to get to that longer, later, more independent child that we're looking for, longer, later rewards. Does that make sense?
Totally. That makes a ton of sense. It's the alleviating of one distress is just that. It's just one type of distress that's been alleviated. It's not everything. And, you know, I feel like my comment earlier may be perceived as a little bit judgmental or challenging towards parents when I say, what are the parents doing? What is their child doing? What is their child being asked to learn, asked to change, asked to evolve with? And parents are sometimes just shuttling and making connections, but they're not taking the time to self-reflect. I also think that by alleviating those short-term distresses, it cannot last. It cannot endure, because that takes a toll on the parent. That takes time and energy to constantly be, to use the phrase that you used earlier, Katie, of anticipating every little thing ahead of the interaction, and where it's beyond an antecedent, it's now like, oh my gosh, I'm just constantly clearing the path. That is exhausting for the parent. And I'm a strong believer that when you become a parent, you don't stop being a whole person. You still are your whole person, your whole self, and you need to honor that person by taking care of you and taking care of your needs too, and not just depleting yourself constantly. And I worry that can turn into the same type of resentment and frustrated perception of the child that the child might be experiencing in the school setting because of their behavior, you know, and quietly internalizing that and building a little bit of a sore spot about it over time. So I do love that with this evidence-based procedure, you can address not only the child's needs, but your needs too, which then can turn into a much more positive cycle of reinforcement of, I'm so proud of you for being so independent and so capable and so strong. And I'm proud of myself for raising a wonderful person and for being able to support you in a way that helps you grow on your own too. And yeah, I just wanted to circle back to that, because if you keep treating those short-term needs, you're going to lose the long game, and it's going to be a bitter pill.
I love that, Julia. I think you did a great job of summing that up and taking the long view. I really love that you said that.
We have you sort of touched a little bit on some of the programs and the techniques that are out there for parents. And what we're going to do is put a lot of links in the show notes and on the podcast page for this episode. We've referred to the SPACE program, which is accessible to providers as a training. There are links there for parents to find providers who have been trained in that program if it sounds interesting for our families. We also will link to Jill's information. And so if she has other supports, people can reach out to her. All right. Thank you so much, Jill, for your time today, and Julia, for guiding this conversation. I feel like there's so much more we could talk about, and maybe we will get another chance to do that. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. It was really fun. Thank you, Katie. Thank you, Julia.
Yeah, thank you. I feel like I've been sitting amongst experts, and it was lovely. Thank you.
Thank you so much for spending some time with us. Please consider checking out the website www.vigiobx.com to find more helpful resources from our guests, and from other professionals using acceptance and commitment training to support parents and children. You can leave comments or requests on the podcast page, find more information about our guests, and subscribe to our newsletter as well. We have a recommended book list, a blog, and options for a free 30-minute consultation if you're interested in working with us. Go gently and have a great day.